From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Ukraine crisis. France pushing for Syrian referral to the International Criminal Court. A Buja blast impacts lives and livelihoods. Plus, Biden says Boston Marathon bombing survivors. Proof U.S. can't be defeated. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Ukrainian airborne troops have landed at an airport in the east of the country at the start of an apparent crackdown on pro-Russian separatists occupying government buildings in 10 localities near the Russian border. Earlier, Ukraine's interim president, Oleksandr Turchynov, said government forces had begun a cautious operation in Ukraine's Russian-speaking east after a deadline for armed protesters to surrender passed on Monday with no movement. Mr. Turchynov told lawmakers that Russia has intentionally inflamed the situation in eastern Ukraine.
Російської Федерації були і залишаються.
He said the Russian Federation's plans were and will remain brutal. He added that Moscow wants to have the whole south and the east of Ukraine be under fire. Meantime, Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev said Tuesday that he hoped the Ukrainian leaderships, in his words, have brains to prevent a further escalation of the conflict in the east of the country.
Ukraine is on the brink of a civil war. It's scary.
He said, Ukraine is on the brink of war. He said, it's scary. Meantime, the Obama administration has suggested that Ukraine's operations against pro-Russian separatists are justified, but that the U.S. is not considering providing lethal assistance. More from White House correspondent Luis Ramirez.
Without going as far as stating U.S. support for the Ukrainian government's decision to send in tanks and troops, White House spokesman Jay Carney told reporters the United States appreciates Ukraine's pledge that it will act responsibly and gradually against the separatists who have taken over government buildings and other facilities.
That said, the Ukrainian government has the responsibility to provide law and order. And these provocations in eastern Ukraine are creating a situation in which the government has to respond.
The Ukrainian government dispatched what it said are anti-terrorist forces to take back government buildings that armed pro-Russian militias have seized in the last few days. Carney repeated U.S. warnings for Russia to pull back its troops from its border with Ukraine and engage in dialogue with the Ukrainian government. He called the situation a dangerous and volatile one and commended Ukraine for what he said has been its measured response. The U.S. official said President Obama is considering expanding sanctions, including if Russia decides to send troops into Ukraine. Carney said the U.S. administration is not considering sending lethal assistance to Ukraine at this time. He said the focus remains on diplomatic efforts to get Russia to stop supporting secessionists in Ukraine. Diplomatic efforts will continue Thursday in Geneva, where U.S., Russian, Ukrainian, and European Union officials will meet to discuss ways to de-escalate the crisis. U.S. officials have suggested more sanctions could come after that meeting if they do not reach an agreement with Russia. Vice President Joe Biden heads to Kiev next week to offer U.S. reassurances to the Ukrainian government. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
And the United Nations is saying widespread corruption, propaganda, and misinformation are to blame for the escalating tensions in Ukraine. In a report released Tuesday, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights calls for perpetrators of rights violations to be held accountable for their actions. Lisa Schlein reporting from the UN in Geneva.
The United Nations report looks at the root causes of the crisis facing Ukraine. It blames current disquieting events in the country on widespread corruption and economic inequality, on lack of accountability for human rights violations by security forces, and on a weak rule of law. The UN Human Rights Office says protests in November in Ukraine's capital, Kiev, which were largely peaceful, turned violent and became radicalized because of the excessive use of force by the Berkut Special Police and other security forces. The report says 121 people, mainly protesters, died during the demonstrations. It also cites numerous cases of torture and ill-treatment. The UN investigators say Violations related to the Maidan protests should be investigated and perpetrators held accountable. Gianni Magazzini is chief of the Americas, Europe, and Central Asia branch of the UN Human Rights Office. He says the current disintegration of the situation in Ukraine is due to the lack of respect for international norms and the rule of law. He says the government must ensure good governance and the protection of minority rights.
One issue that the press release issued by the High Commissioner this morning says is, of course, avoiding misinformation, propaganda, and incitement to hatred. Because, of course, if there are different narratives, if there are different points of views as to what are the facts on the ground, there are possibility for those to increase the level of insecurity, increasing the potential for violence, for non-respect of international human rights norms.
The report released Tuesday is based on information collected during two missions to Ukraine in March by Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights Ivan Simonovich and a team of UN rights monitors on the ground. Monitors found credible allegations of harassment, arbitrary arrests and torture targeting activists and journalists who were opposed to the March 16 referendum annexing Crimea to Russia. The UN report also criticizes the lack of freedom of expression and assembly and other key rights in the disputed region. The investigators note the situation in eastern Ukraine, home to a large ethnic Russian minority, is particularly tense. Magazzini tells VOA the government made a mistake when it sought to repeal a law that deemed Russian a regional language in southern and eastern Ukraine. He says the acting president has addressed this problem by vetoing the proposal.
The government of Ukraine is doing all what is necessary in order to address some of the underlying human rights issues and trying to prepare the country for the elections on 25th May, which we hope will be free and fair and which will even more consolidate their ability to work fully in line with the Constitution of 2004 and the international human rights requirement they have.
Among its many recommendations, the United Nations report calls for all those who have committed human rights violations during the unrest to be held accountable. It says all citizens should have the right to participate equally in public affairs and political life. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. The submarine being used to look for missing Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 was back in the water after its first attempt ended prematurely in the southern Indian Ocean, northwest of Perth, Australia. The Bluefin 21 sub was about 4 hours into its second dive, its mission today. Late on Tuesday, Malaysian Acting Transport Minister Hishamuddin Hussein spoke to reporters about the underwater data, which has been collected so far by the Bluefin.
I know for a fact that they are analyzing those photographs, and I believe when it's been corroborated and they feel comfortable, they will release it to the media.
Flight 370 disappeared with 239 people on board on March 8th on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. Vietnam's release of two more prominent political activists this month may be Hanoi's way of meeting U.S. expectations, not a change in its policy. Vietnam expert Jonathan London of City University of Hong Kong told VOA's Victor Beatty there continues to be what he calls an aggressive crackdown on dissent against those who are only trying to express their constitutionally guaranteed right of free expression. Vietnam is currently negotiating a free trade deal with the United States, and some U.S. lawmakers who must approve such an agreement have vowed to block it if Hanoi fails to improve its human rights record. London says Hanoi may view the release as the price it has to pay for improved relations with countries who will help it improve its economy.
I think Vietnam is extremely keen to improve its relations internationally with a range of countries, including the United States. And it's obvious that the rights record remains an obstacle. whether or not international pressure is sufficient to achieve a real change is less certain. What we have in Vietnam at the moment appears to resemble what we've seen in the past, which is that around the time that certain international agreements are being negotiated, we see this sort of conciliatory behavior, which is then followed by a new campaign of repression. And so, you know, what needs to occur, what many, many Vietnamese are looking for, is a real change in policy. And that would entail a commitment to stop this pattern of arrest and intimidating and imprisoning political dissidents and others who are simply calling for real reforms in Vietnam. I think Vietnam has a great deal to gain from improvements with respect to human rights. And, you know, I think that sooner the country is able to undertake real changes in its human rights policies, the sooner the country will be able to join in the international agreements that it seeks.
Jonathan, how badly does Vietnam need the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement?
Well, as has been widely noted, Vietnam's economy remains full of promise, but it is suffering some stagnancy. And this has to do with largely the way in which the economy is governed. And so what the TPP promises Vietnam is an expansion of trade and also trade that is not subject to tariffs, which lessen the benefit of that trade with the United States. And so if Vietnam can achieve entry into the TPP, and if the TPP is ratified, which remains a major question anyways, Vietnam stands to gain significantly. Interestingly, TPP contains provisions that require exports in order to qualify for reductions in trade tariffs to be manufacturers that are comprised of parts that originate within the TPP group. And so one possible knock-on benefit of TPP membership would be a movement within Vietnam to incorporate greater shares of finished products production within Vietnam itself. In other words, for example, the export of apparel to the United States in order to qualify for TPP tariff reductions would have to be manufactured of materials produced in Vietnam. And so there's already speculation that Chinese investors, for example, who would seek to benefit from TPP indirectly could relocate some of their production of items such as buttons and zippers and other fittings to be incorporated into Vietnamese manufactured apparel. So what you see is, you know, a variety of different ways in which TPP could possibly benefit Vietnam's economy. But essentially what it would be to expand trade and make trade more lucrative for Vietnam.
Jonathan London of City University of Hong Kong was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty.
Start your days with VOA's Daybreak Asia.
Daybreak Asia.
While Asia slept the night before, we've been hard at work gathering the news and talking with the newsmakers so you'll have the news you need to know for the day ahead. Pushing yesterday's stories forward and getting Washington's take on what's going on across the region, the Daybreak Asia team brings you the unique, where other media are merely repeating what you already know. Get a fresh perspective to begin your day, starting at 22 hours Universal Time, Monday through Friday, here on The Voice of America.
In the aftermath of the worst terrorist attack on the Nigerian capital since an insurgency began there in 2009, survivors say they escaped with their lives but lost everything else. Officials say they are looking at ways to help the bombing victims and boosting security ahead of the World Economic Forum for Africa to be held in Nigeria next month. Heather Murdoch is in Abuja with our report.
At this Abuja hospital, some bomb blast victims moan softly, but most sleep. They've lost limbs and been burnt. Vere Ivbezem, a fruit seller, had her jaw nearly knocked off by the blast that hit Monday as she was boarding a bus, killing 71 people and injuring at least 124 others. But she says it's not just lives that were lost.
All my money, all my hands, everything I know, anything, only my life, I hope. I thank God for that. May government help us.
Outside the hospital, Benny Lahr, the chair of the Committee on Human Rights in the National Assembly, says many victims of the bombing were working-class people, barely scraping by in Abuja's satellite towns. The satellite towns are where civil servants and other employees of Nigeria's pristine capital live because they can't afford to stay in the city. The towns are notorious for lacking electricity, clean water, and for bad roads. Lahr says the government should find a way to help the blast victims recover economically.
Those that have lost their breadwinners or their families, they would definitely need some relief and some economic reintegration to the families of the victims.
Emergency management officials say they will be paying the hospital bills, but they have not determined if there will be any other form of compensation. The Director General of Abuja's FCT Emergency Management Agency, Abbas Idris, says the government is working to coordinate hospital response to mitigate the suffering of any future attacks. But Monday's attack, the first in 2 years in the capital, was so devastating that authorities don't have enough room for the bodies.
The situation is that it's not really accommodating the victims. So that is why we have to look for alternative places to relocate all the corpses.
Idris also says the local government is increasing security ahead of the World Economic Forum for Africa next month. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack, but analysts blame Boko Haram, an Islamist militant group that has killed thousands of people, saying it wants to enforce its harsh version of Islamic law. Most of the violence has been in the Northeast, where three states have been under emergency rule for nearly a year. Nigeria's military says it has largely contained the group, reclaiming formerly occupied lands, arresting and killing insurgents, and scattering many who escaped. But large-scale deadly attacks continue, and rights groups say more than 1,500 people have been killed this year alone. And at the Nyanya Motor Park, hours after the attack, Vera Achoen, a local English teacher, points to dozens of bombed-out city buses and says she fears the conflict is spreading.
Many died. Many. All those buses you see there, people were all filled inside to go, and then they had not yet gone. The drivers, the ones that survived, you see them swimming in blood.
The Nigerian Security and Civil Defense Corps says it will deploy 100,000 extra security guards on the roads and around churches for the upcoming Easter holiday. Boko Haram has threatened Christians and previously attacked churches on Christian holidays. However, the vast majority of its victims have been Muslims. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
As part of its effort to refer the situation in Syria to the International Criminal Court, France presented graphic images Tuesday from the so-called Caesar Report of individuals allegedly tortured, starved, and killed by the Syrian government. VOA's Margaret Bashir reporting now from the UN in New York.
Nearly 60 countries have demanded that Syria be referred to the court in The Hague, but it is up to the majority in the UN Security Council to decide to send it there. The council has been very divided over the Syrian crisis, and the Russians and Chinese have previously blocked other resolutions related to the situation. They could veto any effort to refer Syria to the ICC. French Ambassador Gerard Araud told reporters his government is going to try to persuade all council members to support a referral.
It will be to the ICC to investigate everything and to decide on every crime committed in Syria by the regime. I have said it several times. We are not politicizing. It's not a charge against the regime. It's all the crimes committed, and crimes are also committed by the opposition.
At the news conference with the French ambassador were two members of the team of legal and medical experts that studied the 55,000 photographs of 11,000 bodies smuggled out of Syria by a former sergeant in the Syrian military police. Earlier Tuesday, the experts briefed members of the Security Council. Their job was to give an opinion on the credibility of the man who was given the codename Caesar and on the authenticity of the pictures. David Crane is the former first chief prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone. He told reporters it is rare to receive such a cache of what they determine to be credible evidence.
In our business, we rarely have direct, specific, photographic and written evidence of crimes against humanity, war crimes, or genocide. Most of these thugs don't write this stuff down.
Crane and his colleague, British forensic scientist Stuart Hamilton, showed a series of disturbing and graphic photos of corpses that had endured horrific torture, including what appeared to be brutal beatings, chemical burns, bruises, strangulation, and starvation. Hamilton said there are few reasons an individual would have such injuries unless the intent was to inflict pain.
I have not seen much like this in my career, and I can think of no natural or innocent explanation as to how someone could come to look like this.
The investigators said Caesar did not receive any compensation for the photographs and that he put himself at great personal risk over a two-year period to copy the pictures and then smuggle them out of Syria. Before the Syrian conflict began in March 2011, Caesar had worked for 13 years as a crime scene photographer for the Syrian military police. After 2011, he was assigned to photograph corpses at a military hospital that received bodies from three detention centers in the Damascus suburbs. Working through another individual, he was eventually smuggled out of Syria last year in an elaborate ruse that included faking his own death. A handful of the pictures were first made public in a British newspaper in January as the government and opposition were meeting in Geneva in a bid to end the conflict. Those talks ended in failure. The investigation was funded by the Arab Gulf state of Qatar, which has supported the opposition in the Syrian crisis, leading to some skepticism about the credibility of the photographs. The Syrian government has dismissed the Caesar report as politicized. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
U.S. Vice President Joe Biden says the one-year anniversary of the deadly bombings at the Boston Marathon is not just an important day for survivors, but an important day for the entire United States. The two bombs, which authorities say were planted near the marathon finish line by ethnic Chechen brothers Tamerlan and Jokhar Tsarnaev, killed three people, wounded more than 250 others. Mr. Biden spoke Tuesday in Boston at an anniversary ceremony.
And next Monday, on Patriots Day, when I'm told up to 36,000 people line up to start the marathon, you will send a resounding message around the world, not just to the rest of the world, but to the terrorists, that we will never yield. We will never cower. America will never, ever, ever stand down. We are Boston. We are America. We respond. We endure. We overcome. And we own the finish line.
The attack on April 21st last year set off a multi-day manhunt that ended with Tamerlan Tsarnaev dead from a shootout with police and a bloody Jokhar being arrested in a Boston suburb. Jokhar is due to go on trial in November on 30 federal charges and will face the death penalty. The Boston Marathon is one of the most prestigious in the world and has been held every year since 1897. This year's race features an expanded field of runners, about 9,000 more than in 2013. The man accused of a deadly shooting spree outside two Jewish community sites in the U.S. state of Kansas was charged with murder on Tuesday. 73-year-old Frazier Glenn Cross could face the death penalty if convicted. He could also face federal hate crimes charges, which too carry the death penalty. Cross is a Vietnam War veteran and a longtime white supremacist. He shouted a Nazi slogan at TV cameras as he was arrested after Sunday's killings. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zubair Al-Tayeb, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On April 16, 73 AD, the Great Jewish Revolt came to an end when Roman troops successfully ended the three-year stand by the Zealots at Masada. On this day in 1521, Protestant reformer Martin Luther arrived in the German city of Worms to make an appearance before the Diet, or General Assembly, of the Holy Roman Empire. When asked to denounce his writings, Luther proclaimed, "I cannot and will not recant anything, since it is neither safe nor right to go against conscience." The Diet declared Luther a heretic and called for his arrest. On this day in 1917, the leader of Russia's Bolshevik Party, Vladimir Lenin, returned from exile to Petrograd, modern-day St. Petersburg, to organize a revolt against the weak post-Tsarist provisional government. On this day in 1947, former presidential advisor Bernard Baruch used the term Cold War to describe relations between the United States and Russia. Instantly embraced by newspapers, the term was an apt description for the battle between the two ideological foes. And in this week of 1969, Desmond Dekker and the Aces, with their Jamaican sound, rose to the top of the British charts with The Israelites.
Get up in the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed. Oh, me Israelites,
before the ascent of Bob Marley, Desmond Dekker was one of the most popular musicians within Jamaica and one of the best-known Jamaican-style musicians outside of it. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Americans on April 7th joined people around the world as they paused to mark the 20 years since the start of the genocide in Rwanda that took the lives of more than 800,000 men, women, and children. Reflecting on the tragedy, President Barack Obama, Secretary of State John Kerry, and U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power reaffirmed the U.S. commitment to help ensure that other nations do not face the suffering that Rwandans endured two decades ago. As they honor the memories of those who were lost, Rwandans have also much to be proud of. They have rebuilt their nation from a tiny rural economy to one of the fast-growing economies of the world, with thriving agricultural and tourism sectors. According to the World Bank, since 1994, Rwanda has reduced poverty by a third and increased per capita growth almost fivefold. We stand in awe of the families who have summoned the courage to carry on, and the survivors who have worked through their wounds to rebuild their lives, President Obama said. And we salute the determination of the Rwandans who have made important progress toward healing old wounds, unleashing the economic growth that lifts people from poverty, and contributing to peacekeeping missions around the world to spare others the pain that they have known. As the United States marks the Rwandan tragedy, we are committed to pursue more effective ways to identify countries at risk for genocide, mass atrocities, and other human rights abuses throughout the world. With the creation of the Atrocities Prevention Board in 2012, the U.S. government brought together numerous government agencies and departments to address these issues. We also continue to promote human rights and policies of inclusion to prevent the tensions and circumstances that can lead to violence. A government that passes a law restricting civil society hinders its citizens' freedoms of peaceful assembly, association, and expression, thereby setting the stage for frustration and possibly violence. Finally, the United States continues to support mechanisms to ensure accountability for genocide so that would-be perpetrators know that the international community will demand justice. Let us honor the victims of 1994 by ensuring that genocide never occurs again.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.